You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Hello, Lionel. And Daniel Freeb.
Hello.
Daniel, what's the headgear this week?
Oh, Zed.
Zed team. I can't see it in the shadows.
Can you see it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, nice.
Any reason for that? Is that an homage to anything or anyone in particular?
Big Wayne Bennington fan, Daniel, I'd imagine.
Wayne Bennington, no. No, I'm afraid not. Just been for a run. My preferred headgear today was the Zed casket. Huge day for sport in the United Kingdom, not because I went for a run. Golf courses are open again.
Oh.
Massive.
Wow.
Massive. That's how much you've missed them, that...
Pop open the champagne.
Mown fairways. I'm going to get my first game in tomorrow after fleeing before fleeing the United Kingdom for a while.
You're off, aren't you, Daniel? You're heading back to your spiritual home.
Well, I'm heading back to Germany, all above board, all necessary,
paperwork completed.
Paperwork will be fulfilled. I should hastily add, yes.
Well, I've been doing a bit of border crossing myself. In the last few days, I had a little mini break in Belgium, staying in lovely Oudenaarde. I had my bike there, and I took in E3 and Gent-Wevelgem at the weekend. So we'll hear a little package. Sorry, Lionel, you look like you're going to say something there.
Where did you finish?
I didn't finish. I did my ride on Saturday. I took in the races on Friday and Sunday, both really great races and very different races. So we'll be covering those in this episode. We'll hear from Mathieu van der Poel, Tim de Klerk, Matteo Trentin, Nathan van Hooydonk and Marianne Vos in my little package from Flanders. Also from Jan-Peter de Vlieger of Het Nieuwsblad newspaper. We had some interesting things to say about De Koning Quickstep and their future as well. So we'll maybe talk a bit about that later on. But before we get into all that, and talking about Catalonia as well, of course, do you have a news roundup for us, please, Lionel?
I do, Rich. Yeah, very, very busy week of racing, of course. A great week if you ride for De Koning Quickstep, mostly, Ineos Grenadiers or Jumbo Visma, or also a great week for the Danes. Danish cyclists had a fantastic week.
De Koning Quickstep, or Etics, as Anthony Turgis called them in his post-race interview yesterday.
Was that deliberately casting a bit of shade on them by referring to them by a name that's about 8 years out of date?
Yeah, they were. That was their incarnation when, of course, famously, Ian Stannard tucked them up like kippers at Het Volk in 2015, I think. I think Etics' last season was 16 or 17.
Well, it's great to see Turgis, the Europe car rider, doing so well, isn't it? I mean, he's a man reborn. Extraordinary performance from him again. But we'll maybe come to that later on.
I say it was a great week for De Koning Quickstep because they won the first two of the week's three Belgian races. Sam Bennett took the sprint in the OxyClean Brugge De Panne Classic. And then the Danish champion Kasper Asgreen rode absolutely brilliantly to take E3 Saxo Bank Classic, which starts and finishes in Harelbeke. They played the numbers game brilliantly, De Koning Quickstep, in that race to beat Mathieu van der Poel, who was third. Florian Seneschal of De Koning Quickstep made it a 1-2 for them. We'll talk all about that race in our cobbled wrap-up. Wout van Aert had a difficult day on Friday. He basically... he had a puncture. He had to get back on with the help of his teammate. And then, he was the architect of his own downfall, wasn't he?
Dropped himself.
He basically set himself on fire.
It's extraordinary, wasn't it?
It was, I wondered about that, whether it was an elaborate double bluff, but probably not. Anyway, he bounced back on Sunday to win Gent-Wevelgem, thanks to some fantastic teamwork from Nathan van Hooydonk, the nephew of two-time Tour of Flanders winner Edward van Hooydonk. Van Aert out-sprinted Giacomo Nizzolo, Matteo Trentin, Sonny Colbrelli and Michael Matthews. And one man who wasn't there to contest the sprint was Sam Bennett, who'd ridden brilliantly all day. He'd been in the long break. But then, after a huge effort on the Kemmelberg to stay in touch, was throwing up. Really,
well, big incentive for those other guys to get up the road away from him, wasn't there at that point?
It was. Yeah,
it was quite elaborate. Some projectile vomiting from his bike.
Indeed. The two women's races were Grace Brown won the women's Brugge di Panna Classic for Bike Exchange, and then Marianne Vos got her first win in Jumbo-Visma colours at Gent-Wevelgem. The two races were affected by coronavirus because Bora Hansgrohe missed both at E3 and Gent-Wevelgem because of a case in their team, Matt Walls, I think it was, and Trek Segafredo missed Sunday's race, meaning that Mads Pedersen couldn't defend his title. And as we speak, we don't know for certain whether Paris-Roubaix is going to go ahead in a couple of weeks' time. At the moment, the race is still on. Richard, is there any further news on the situation in northeastern France?
Not really. There have been lots of reports that that Paris-Roubaix has been cancelled because there's pressure from local politicians in Lille around Roubaix. But as far as I know, ASO have not made any decision, and ASO haven't even been instructed one way or the other. So for the moment, Paris-Roubaix is on, and speaking to some of the teams yesterday, they're all planning as if it's on at the moment. But that could change. And there's rumours of an address from Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, on Wednesday. There could be new lockdown measures in France later this week. So we wait to find out.
And chaps, some employees of ASO, might even have been Christian Prudhomme himself, were sighted. I think they were spotted on the Paris-Roubaix course. I think after the report in Le Parisien, there was sort of speculation that ASO were out there on the course trying to figure out ways to make the course safe so that they could present that to the French government. And hopefully a compelling case which will lead to the race still going ahead. Talking of sightings, Tom Dumoulin has apparently been spotted out training on his time trial bike. I presume in kit.
Yes, in kit, in Jumbo-Visma kit even. So that's encouraging, isn't it? He's on a break from racing. Unclear whether or if he will return, but that does seem quite encouraging.
Well, while the cobbles were going on in Belgium, the cobbled races were going on in Belgium. The stage races were
Lionel.
The stage races were in Catalonia, where Ineos Grenadiers completed a clean sweep of the podium places. Adam Yates took the top step by winning the hardest stage of the race to Valter 2000. Richie Porte was second overall and Geraint Thomas third overall. Rowan Dennis also won the time trial stage for Ineos, so a good week for them in Catalonia. And we witnessed the rebirth of Esteban Chavez, who was second the day that Yates won the stage and then went one better the following day. The Colombians had a pretty tough time over the last two seasons with illness and injury, and that was his first win since the 2019 Giro. There were also a couple of stage wins for Bora Hansgrohe with Leonard Kamna and Peter Sagan, and two for Lotto Soudal. Andreas Kron kicked off the race with the opening stage, and Thomas de Gendt took the final one around Barcelona in a pretty spectacular Thomas de Gendt type style. Meanwhile, over in Italy, a smaller race, but one with a famous name, the Settimana Coppi e Bartali, which was won by Jumbo-Visma's Danish rider Jonas Vingegaard, which is how that's the house style for Jonas Vingegaard's name. Daniel, you're...
Vingegaard.
I don't... I mean, we can debate this if you like. I'm sure Danish listeners can... Danish listeners, tell us on Twitter or drop us a line whether...
Let's ask Brian Nigar.
That's true.
Or Michal Miku.
We check this with the chief inspector of the pronunciation police during the Vuelta last year. And we also got a recording from one of Lizzie Banks' teammates, I think, a Danish rider. Is that not right, Richard?
Emma Norsgaard.
There we are. Yeah. Anyway, Vingegaard won two stages as well. And Mark Cavendish had a day in the leader's jersey after his second place in the opening sprint and a good ride by De Koninck Quickstep in the team time trial. Daniel, any update from Mark Cavendish?
Well, a very welcome, I suppose, return to form is almost understating it. Obviously, it's been an awfully long time since Mark, he had a leader's jersey. He still hasn't got that first win, but came very close on the first day. And I spoke to him briefly that evening when he did have the leader's jersey. And I think, you know, he doesn't want to obviously get carried away, and someone who has achieved as much as he has in his career doesn't want to be seen either to be celebrating, you know, what, as far as he is concerned, quite small steps forward. But he's been through an awful lot over the last 3 or 4 years. There's no secret about that, you know, injury problems, illness, even mental health problems that he's spoken about. And I think it was a huge moment for him this week, when really that leader's jersey and that result on the first day just confirmed that he's competitive again. And it did, I think, feel like a reward for his perseverance more than anything, because he's been written off by a lot of people over the last year or two. And, you know, let's face it, we've doubted as well at times that he was going to become competitive again. He looked a long way away from that, certainly in the second half of last year.
Should mention that the rider who beat Cavendish in that opening stage was Jakub Marečko. The other stages were won by Ethan Hayter, a young British rider with Ineos Grenadiers, and Mikkel Honoré, who is both Danish and rides for De Koninck Quickstep. A really quite extraordinary run of results for Ineos, Jumbo-Visma and De Koninck Quickstep. I mean, if you don't ride for one of those three teams, you're up against it. But a race that was won by a rider from another team, the Grand Prix Cholet in France. Elia Viviani sprinted to victory for Cofidis. But the sprint finish was really notable for the manoeuvre by Nasser Bouhanni, who crossed the line third but was then relegated / disqualified for what was pretty dangerous sprinting. He put Jake Stewart of Groupama FDJ right up into the barriers, and Stewart did incredibly well to stay upright. It could have been very nasty, that, but it looked from the overhead shot like nice smooth barriers, so there weren't any feet sticking out or anything to cause a real serious incident. But I don't know what you made of that manoeuvre. Difficult to tell just from that overhead shot, but unequivocal that Bouhanni veered off his line quite dramatically.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if the UCI take any action on that, because they banned Dylan Groenewegen for 9 months for his manoeuvre at the Tour of Poland. And it raises the question of whether incidents are punished according to the manoeuvre itself or the outcome. And, you know, in Poland, there was a terrible outcome for Fabio Jakobsen. Here, as you say, Jake Stewart did very well to remain upright, but that doesn't really make the manoeuvre any less dangerous or, you know, condemnable. So the UCI have set quite a precedent by banning Groenewegen for 9 months, and it'll be interesting to see whether they take any action here. I would suggest this was just as bad a manoeuvre.
Yeah, it was disappointing, chaps, wasn't it? I mean, Bouhanni is someone that I have always, you know, wanted to like. You know, when I speak to him at races, I always find him pretty personable. And unfortunately, he makes that really hard at times, because he's had so many different, well, opportunities. He's had people who have made allowances for him, but he just keeps making the same mistake. I mean, we're not talking about two or three times that he's done this kind of thing in sprint finishes. You know, it's sort of half a dozen or a dozen times when this has happened, and then there have been other incidents off the bike as well. So, and pretty disappointing. And his results have not really been of a level where teams will continue to make excuses and allowances. And he hasn't really produced the RKR in the last couple of years.
We were informed this week by ASO that the 2023 Tour de France will start in Bilbao in the Basque Country in northern Spain. Remember, this year's race starts in Brittany and next year is in Copenhagen. So looking forward to a trip to Bilbao. Great city, Rich. One you know quite well, isn't it?
Very much
Bilbao,
so, yeah.
San Sebastian, yeah. Nice part of the world. And there's been a big story in the Mail on Sunday about British cycling and an incident which dates back to the end of 2010, which has sparked an investigation by WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, which is going to be investigating the United Kingdom Anti-Doping Agency, UCAD, for allowing British cycling to commission its own testing. Now, this apparently happened in the wake of concern that nandrolone, trace samples of nandrolone, which is a threshold substance, were found in a rider's sample late in 2010, and some private testing was commissioned, which is not allowed under the WADA code. You're not allowed to do your own tests for a banned or controlled substance. So an investigation into UCAD and BC by WADA, and a story that's making a lot of noise over the weekend. Any other news, Daniel?
Well, there was some news, chaps, from someone we haven't heard from for a while, a number of years, and in fact, I've never heard very much from, but has made a lot of headlines over the years. See if you know who this is.
Ciclistas, atletas, futbolistas, boxeadores.
¿Cree que alguien puede estar nervioso ante lo que usted pueda decir?
Eso casi seguro.
¿Usted dopaba, señor Fuentes?
Define dopaje.
¿Usted hacía trampas, señor Fuentes?
Sí. Y no conozco a nadie que no las hiciera.
So, chaps, any ideas?
Spanish. Somewhat Spanish.
Breaking his silence at last. Was it Piers Morgan?
It was our old mate, Eufemiano Fuentes.
Oh, mate. Were you a client, Daniel?
I can't comment on that. He has been making headlines in France because he has broken his silence. Fuentes, never someone who spoke an awful lot in the press. Of course, we're talking about the doping doctor, infamous doping doctor at the centre of the Operación Puerto scandal in 2006 and other assorted scandals over the years. And a Spanish sort of investigative show, Lord de Evole, has tracked him down. This is a program that, well, has featured interviews with very sort of enigmatic, elusive personalities, and Fuentes was the last one, or the latest one, on the Oki, and he's been talking about football, his links, of course. You know, there's been a lot of speculation over the years about how closely he was linked to Spanish football teams, Barcelona, Real Madrid, Valencia, Real Sociedad. And also about doping in general, a little bit about cycling and track and field athletics. But it was a typical Fuentes appearance, you know, lots of nudging and winking. And one got the sense that he was very much enjoying being the centre of attention again and determined to sort of preserve and perpetuate that this caddish, mysterious sort of Robin Hood of doping kind of image that he has had over the years. And, you know, there'll no doubt be a lot of talk over the next few days about what did and didn't come out. As I said, there were sort of morsels. He dangled a few more bits of information which suggested those stories, those rumoured links with Real Madrid and Barcelona over the years are not just sort of tittle-tattle. There is something to them. But yeah, it was a pretty interesting half an hour or so.
Just finally, some breaking news, chaps. UCI have released a statement just now about Nasser Bouhanni condemning his dangerous conduct. And they say the UCI has decided to refer the incident to its disciplinary commission and demand the imposition of sanctions that are appropriate to the seriousness of this action.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iWalker.co.uk. iWOCA.co.uk.
Well, that's the last time we'll hear that little ditty thanking iWalker for their support of the Cycling Podcast. They have been our title sponsor for just over a year. And we are incredibly grateful to them, not least because it has been a year like no other. And our agreement with iWalker was signed off just before we went into lockdown and racing stopped. And we weren't sure what we were going to do. But one thing we were sure of was that we had iWalker's full support throughout that. And we're very, very grateful to them. They've been fantastic sponsors for us. The contact was made through a listener who heard that we were losing our previous title sponsor, Rafa, got in touch and it went from there. And, well, iWalker are big cycling advocates, big cycling fans. They support the Kendal Cycle Club as well. And, yeah, thank you very much to iWalker. We couldn't have carried on in the way that we've done over the past year. That includes producing our Giro and other things without their support, and the Grandest Tour, of course. So big, big thank you to iWalker. Very, very grateful. Now, let's cross over to Belgium and my little package from E3 and Gent-Wevelgem. We start off in Ypres with at the start of Gent-Wevelgem in conversation with Jan-Peter de Vlieger of Het Nieuwsblad. But I think we're going to hear some bagpipes first.
Thank you.
Well, it was the bagpipes at the in Ypres at the start of Gent-Wevelgem. I'm here with Jan-Peter de Vlieger, or Jasper Stuyven.
Which character should I be?
Well, I was hoping to interview Jasper Stuyven this morning, and I turned up and learned that he was not starting with the rest of his Trek Segafredo team. A couple of COVID cases in the team, apparently, so no Mads Pedersen either, the defending champion. But JP, lovely to hear the bagpipes here in Ypres for the start of Gent-Wevelgem. Why does Gent-Wevelgem not start in Ghent?
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. As I'm living in Ghent, I got up really, really early to get here to the start. But why doesn't it start in Ghent anymore? Mostly because I think Ypres offered a better deal to Flanders Classics. And this kind of plays into the whole Great War team that they have going on. And I think it's quite a good way, a nice way of showcasing all the historical venues here.
No chance of a change of name. I mean, it continues that great tradition in cycling of, you know, 3 days of Depan, 4 days of Dunkirk, Gent-Wevelgem, which actually starts in Ypres. It's the second year it started here, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. It's getting a bit silly, or at least confusing with all the names, but I don't think they'll change it back to, or change it to Ypres-Wevelgem. It's the second year indeed. They made a big investment. They were hoping that it would create a lot of extra income for hotels, for restaurants, for bars, but both editions so far have been COVID editions, so that hasn't paid off for now.
A shame, but a really stunning start under the Menin gate there. And as I say, it was lovely to hear the bagpipes guy in his kilt. I don't know if he was a Scot or a Belgian, but it was nice anyway. You can't beat a bit of bagpipes. JP, a couple of days ago we were at E3, a great race. Today Gent-Wevelgem has been a sprinter's race in the past. We don't really, it's quite windy. Kemmelberg as well, obviously a big challenge, but Sam Bennett is here for De Koning Quickstep, and they were the story of Friday's race, weren't they, at E3? Just a phenomenal team performance. You made a comment to me a bit earlier saying that in the podcast we've been quite hard on Mathieu van der Poel, perhaps harder than the press is here. And is that fair to say in Belgium and Holland?
Yeah, I think so. We've been in awe with him mostly. We've noticed the guy, the things that you brought up in the podcast about his positioning, but we're like mostly we're admiring how he can totally recreate or get himself in a better situation in a matter of minutes. But it's true that he is sometimes a bit sloppy, you could say, when it comes to positioning.
Well, his greatest strength is his greatest weakness in a way. I mean, he rides a bit like a junior or an under 23 rider in some ways. He's so strong that he hasn't needed to worry about a lot of these things, but Friday just showed how, when a team is as well organised and committed to the cause as De Koning Quickstep were, what you can do against riders who are stronger than each of their individual riders. Kasper Asgreen was the winner in the end, and at the finish I asked Tim de Klerk about the team performance. He was very involved, as he always is, in the earlier part of the race, so here's what he had to say.
I'm really happy the way we did it. We didn't want to race negative. We want to race our own race. For sure, those guys, you have to take account them, because. But still, we wanted to make our own race and don't ride in a negative way, but ride in a positive way and try to be aggressive in the race. And I think it really, really paid off.
You always had numbers up there. Was that the plan? I mean, were there plans to go at specific moments?
We always have a plan like this, but it's not so easy every time to. But now everything felt into place, and we had a tactic that Bert would open the race on top of the Kortekeer, but I was lucky that I had a good day and I was also still there, so we could do it in two. And then they attacked and they did the perfect race by the book.
Can you do that over an extra 60 kilometers at the Tour of Flanders?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, we have to see, but first enjoy this and then we look forward to the rest of the thing.
That was Tim de Klerk, and I mean, you sort of run out of superlatives to describe that collective performance, and they'll be trying to do the same again, I guess. There was a very touching interview from Mathieu van der Poel where he said he missed Wout. Wout van Aert, a curious performance from him. He attacked himself, dropped himself. And you were telling me, JP, that there's been a bit of criticism of his team in the press here.
Yeah, there's a lot of back and forth whether the team is good enough or not, because The critics of the team said that Wout van Aert was isolated, which is a fact, and it's been so for a few races. You can also bring up the point that his team did a lot of work to bring him to bring van Aert back after he punctured. So yeah, I'm a bit undecided for the moment, but the team has to prove, I think, that they are up to the level of van Aert. And obviously, you have to take into account that with Mike Teunissen, they lost a big man for van Aert. He's the guy you could assume that could be there in all of those finals, I think.
Let's not forget as well, Tom Dumoulin was going to be riding the Tour of Flanders.
Exactly, good
and
point
would have
as
been
well.
Part of this setup too. So they've missed. They're missing a couple of, you know, key players.
They are for sure. And like Eenkhoorn and Nathan van Hooijdonk, they did their job in E3. So it's a bit harsh to say that he has no team. That's definitely not true.
I was fascinated by that line from Van der Poel, though, because or Van der Poel, we've been told off for pronunciation, but it sort of raises possibility that it could be Van Aert and Van der Poel together against De Koning Quickstep in some of these races. And we've tended to focus a lot on the rivalry between Van Aert and Van der Poel, but actually they could be allies against De Koning Quickstep.
Yeah, they could. And I got a call from Roger De Vlaming after E3.
Of course.
Yeah.
That's not quite regular.
That's very regular. Mostly he calls to ask what time the TV broadcast starts. But this time he had a point to make. He said, if Mathieu van der Poel needed Wout van Aert, like he said in the TV interview, why did he drop him at Tegenberg?
I thought van Aert dropped himself.
Well, yeah, he did. But when van der Poel saw that van Aert was struggling, he kind of picked up the pace or made an acceleration. So Roger de Vlaming thought that wasn't really coherent, like saying you need him and then drop him. He thought that van der Poel was like too eager. Oh, I can drop my big rival. I'm going to do it. And he didn't really think of the tactical consequences of that move.
Does de Vlaming ever phone up and shower praise on any of the contemporary riders?
Hasn't happened so far, but maybe after today's race, who knows? Yeah. No, but he's a big fan of van Aert and also van der Poel. And also he ended the call by saying, I couldn't write it in the newspaper, but I think he's all right with me saying it in the podcast, I hope.
Well, it's too late now. It's a great time, though, to be watching these races in particular, I think, because I'd say van der Poel, van Aert, they are brilliant talents, fantastic stars, and yet you can still have a race like Friday's where we see a team come together in the way that De Koning Quickstep did and really sort of show them how to race. The commitment of all those riders to the cause was impressive, and of course at the Tour of Flanders next week they'll have Julian Alaphilippe as well.
Exactly, the team will only be stronger there, but you can ask if they have a sole leader, if they can do like the race tactics they employed in E3 where they can very much improvise and adapt to every scenario. Same here today with Bennett. They have a clear leader. So there's a clear plan at the start, and that might not have been the case at E3.
Seneschal won the sprint for second, and you know I spoke to him at the finish as well because I was kind of curious whether how he felt about Askren going again. That was a great tactic, and it did pay off, but he was potentially the fastest guy in that group, so he was watching the win, what would have been a huge win for him, disappear up the road, but he seemed okay with that.
Exactly, but Patrick Lefevre has pointed this out in his column quite a few times, that everybody in the team is end of contract, so all of his riders are racing for results and for their own market value, and to see such a coherent or a team effort is quite spectacular in those circumstances, I think.
Well, the rider who was third and not riding today, Mathieu van der Poel, I spoke to him at the finish as well. There was an impression I had at Milan-San Remo as well that he perhaps was paying a bit for the efforts in Tirreno Adriatico. He hasn't looked quite as sharp.
That's a point that's been made in the Belgian media as well. I think it's difficult to say, but it's hard to deny that the edge they had or the advantage over their competitors they had in Tirreno, they no longer have it. Whether that is because they're at a slightly lower level or the competition has picked up their level, I don't know, but the facts show that the difference is not as big as it was in Tirreno.
Well, let's hear from Mathieu van der Poel at the finish of E3 on Friday.
Was it just a case today of coming up against a very strong team with lots of strong riders?
Yeah, for sure. And also the wind had an important role. After Stationsberg, I think it was a good effort, but then we turned left on the big road and there was completely headwind, so it was very difficult to make the difference. And yeah, it was too easy in the wheels as well. And then De Koning had a really strong rider in front at Asgreen, and the rest didn't really have to work. So we knew that if we caught Asgreen, it would be difficult to drop the other guys.
And how are you feeling? I mean, a lot of people watch your performance in Tirreno and obviously went very deep on a couple of stages. Do you feel you've fully recovered from that week?
Yeah, the Italian block of racing was pretty hard. I noticed it when I came back from Sanremo. I was pretty tired and I had to take some extra rest. That's why I didn't do the recon neither of this race. So now we will be easy recovering till the last races.
Tour Flanders, I guess, is a big target for you to defend your title from last year.
Yeah, for sure. I'll do my best. But we have to do... We have to think how to create another situation than today.
That was Van der Poel, not riding today, of course. JP, we're in Ypres. We better get ourselves to... It still finishes in Wevelgem, does it?
I hope so. And you're going to give me a lift to the press room, right?
Let's go. Well, I've made it to the finish in windy Wevelgem. Relieved to discover that the finish is still in Wevelgem. And after Friday's phenomenal performance from the Koenig Quickstep, it was back to earth with a bit of a bump for them today. Amazingly, when a 25-man group went clear, there was only one De Koenig rider in it, Sam Bennett, who's also their leader for this race. Bennett said at the start that he couldn't go in with a sprinter's mentality.
Yeah, I think I have to go in and really race it. I forget about the sprint until hopefully you're there at the end of the race. Because yeah, if you wait and you try to save anything, I think the race will be gone up the road. So a bit of a different approach, but something I'm excited about, just to race and enjoy racing.
Well, he certainly didn't ride like the pure sprinter that he so often is, because Sam Bennett and the others in the group, although there was the best part of 200 kilometres still in front of them, really committed to working in that group. Bike Exchange had four riders there, and Jumbo-Visma had two, Wout van Aert and Nathan van Hooijdonk. Van Hooijdonk would have a very significant role to play. It wasn't until the second time of three up the Kemmelberg that the group split up significantly. Nine riders emerged at the front, including some very fast sprinters, Bennett, Nizzolo, Matthews, Trentin, Colbrelli. And third and final time up, van Hooijdonk was tailed off, but he got back on and he was later able to make the acceleration that put paid to Bennett, who'd been vomiting after that final Kemmelberg ascent. It was van Hooijdonk who also then led out the sprint very effectively indeed for his leader van Aert. And van Aert was well positioned and timed his jump just perfectly to win his first Gent-Wevelgem. I spoke to van Hooijdonk at the finish. Well, that was a really important job you had today, but can you tell us how the split happened in the first place?
I think it was Bike Exchange who they made echelons. They were with five guys in the first echelon, I think. I was there with Wout, and for the rest, actually, Matteo Trentin also had a teammate. For us, were all kind of individuals. There was no real control. I think that's also why the Koenig Quickstep missed the first echelon. And from there on, it was just full-on race until the finish.
You had a bit of a hard time last time up the Kemmelberg, but you got back on, and I guess your only thought then was what you could do to help Wout.
Yeah, for sure. Wout was talking to me, and he said, you need to pass the third time, Kemmel. And I was afraid to drop, because I didn't want to disappoint him. I dropped a little bit, but in the end I came back, and I had so much confidence in Wout that he was going to finish it off, and he delivered.
And were you always confident for the sprint? Did you think about, did he think about trying something else, or were you always going to leave it to the sprint?
Well, we didn't really talk tactics, actually. I knew what I had to do. He told me what I had to do, and I did what I had to do.
And you got, with your acceleration, at one point you got rid of Sam Bennett and Van Poppel. Were you aware of that at the time? And you must have been happy to look back and see that.
At that point, I was really on my limit, but I wasn't sure if riders were going to drop. But I took some meters, and then they accelerate behind, so there's a huge tempo change. And then, yeah, if you're on your limit, then it's normal to lose the wheel. And then with the wind, we just keep on turning. It doesn't get easier. After the last time Kemmel, we were the only team with two guys, so yeah, for sure we had to pull it off, and I never doubted our leader.
Well, behind Van Aert were three Italians, Giacomo Nizzolo, Matteo Trentin and Sonny Colbrelli. Trentin spoke at the finish about how the group went clear in the first place, because we didn't see that on the TV, and there was a bit of confusion, some rumours that a crash had caused the split, rumours put about, I think, by De Koenig Quickset riders. That doesn't appear to have been the case, but Trentin did speak a little bit about the bind that they found themselves in, De Koenig, because they wouldn't have been happy with just Bennett in the front group, but on the other hand, he was their leader, so they couldn't chase either. All they could do was try to get bodies across, which they tried with Zdeněk Stybar, Davide Ballerini and Yves Lampaert, but it didn't pay off. Here's Matteo Trentin at the finish.
It was a super hard day, and you can see by the fact that nobody really wanted to attack, or they didn't really try to attack. I think everybody was super committed from the moment the group formed. Nobody really tried to, you know, save energy or saving too much that probably you can see riders sitting in the back and don't pull. Everybody made his part from the start to the finish. And at the end, was just, you know, pure sprint on the final, just pushing as hard as you can. We were all really on the limit, because like when Wout and Nathan forced it on the second time, the Kemmel, it was a group of nine, and then I tried to force it a little bit the third time, but actually everybody was so much on the limit that it wasn't possible to make like a proper split. And also, you need like good legs to get to the final again, because it was again 30k to get to level game. So, of course, with the group we had at the end, was good. We could turn, we could go, and it was super fast. I found myself in the front because I just tried to pass. You know, I was super nervous from when we passed in Ypres again, because you all knew that it was gonna be crosswind. And then one moment, I just passed the group on the side, and I found myself in front with the whole bike exchange team. So I just accelerate, and they take over after me, and in one moment was split. And it was really, that's why probably a lot of teams got catch by surprise, because it was already trying by someone, but it never really worked out. And then that was probably the hardest pull or the best moment, I don't know. And then we went, and from the moment we went, everybody was committed.
Were you surprised there weren't any, well, only one Quickset rider in that
group? Actually, they got the rider that was supposed to be the leader today, so that was also tactically for them wasn't easy. If they chase him or they leave him there, at the end he was there even after the Kemmel. It was, for sure, he was full gas, but chapeau. If one guy can push himself so deep and pass the climb and then have to vomit, this means that you really push yourself over the limit, and Not many sprinters can do that on a classics, so good job.
Well, after the men's race, we had the women's race, continuing the Flanders Classics innovation of putting the women's race after the men's, which means more TV coverage and an extended day's entertainment. There have been two competing narratives so far this season in women's racing, the domination of SD Works and the domination of Elisa Longoborghini. It was a quiet day for SD Works by their recent standards, but not for Longoborghini. The Trek Segafredo rider who was leading the Women's World Tour got away in the final 16 kilometres with another Italian, Soraya Paladin of Live Racing. They almost held on, it was agonising, but even as several teams chasing the front in particular, Canyon SRAM and SD Works, they were caught in the final kilometre. Marina Voss went early. She's never won this race before, surprisingly, but she won here to make a Jumbo-Visma double. This was also the first win for the new Jumbo-Visma women's team. Here is Marina Voss at the finish.
This was one of the first targets for the team to be ready, and I think in the lead up to this race, we did well. So we gained some confidence in the racing before, and we knew we were ready. It's never as easy as it might seem. Everything has to click, and it's fantastic when everything turns out like this today.
What did you think when Longoborghini and Paladin were up the road? Did you think there was a good chance that they might stay clear?
Well, they had a good advantage, but yeah, it was not in their advantage that it's such a wide road, so we could see them all the time. And yeah, there were still some good sprinters in our group, and also some working power. But yeah, it's when Elisa Longo-Borghini and Paladin, two strong girls, are up the road, you know it's dangerous.
Who were you worried about in the sprint? Who were you looking out for?
Well, of course, Kopecky is a very strong contender, but also Balsamo, Brennauer. There were still a lot of good sprinters, so it was being in the right position and then think about your own sprint and not too much worrying about others, but trying to do the best sprint that I could do, and I'm very happy that
you went pretty early.
I actually thought it was late, but then when I went, I knew it was going to be very hard to keep it, but yeah, I tried, and yeah, I was very happy it worked out.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, interrupting our episode briefly to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Curve, which will simplify your life by making your daily finances more efficient. Richard, you have got your Curve card, I believe?
I do have my card. I'm waiting for the physical card, but I've got the card. I've got the app on my phone and the card that I can use through my phone. So I debuted it. Is that right? The right expression? On my bike ride in Flanders at the weekend, I went out without my wallet, but with my phone, with my Curve card on it. And on the Curve card, you have your credit cards, debit cards, Boots card, Tesco card, not much use in Flanders, those things, of course. But you can basically store lots of cards and monitor them all through one place, one app. So it avoids having to carry a big, bulky wallet and carry just one card instead, or indeed have it on your phone.
Yeah, the feature that I'm really looking forward to using is that you can use your Curve card as if you'd use any Visa or MasterCard, and then in the app allocate those purchases to whichever one of your cards you then want that money to be debited on, and you've got quite a window in which you can do that, so you can really manage your finances day to day. And the Curve card also gives you 1% cash back at some of your favourite retailers. And new users will get £5 in Curve cash, which they will get just given to them after their first purchase using the Curve card.
So no accidentally putting personal purchases on the Cycling Podcast card, Lionel.
And, that's a low blow.
Or if you do that, you can rectify it later. And no more experiences, sadly, like the one I had in the Alps a couple of years ago when I left my big fat wallet, fat because it had lots of cards in it, not money, on the car in a petrol station. Do you remember that?
I do remember that. It ruined your day.
It ruined everyone's day, didn't it? Because I remember how quiet the car was driving back to the petrol station and then back to finish. It was actually the day that Geraint Thomas won, the day before Alpe d'Huez, I remember. Anyway, we got there very late as a result of that, and I spent the rest of the afternoon not watching the race but cancelling all my cards. Well, that would be a thing of the past with just one card, Curve, so looking forward to using it as well. I think for travel it's going to be ideal.
If you want to find out more about Curve, to sign up and get £5 of Curve cash after your first purchase as well, go to curve.com/cycle. That's curve.com/cycle.
Well, we heard there from Marina Vos, the winner of the women's race at Gent-Wevelgem, completing that Jumbo-Visma double. And earlier we heard, and big thanks to Jan-Peter de Vlieger of Het Nieuwsblad, and we were talking about E3 and that incredible De Koenig Quickstep performance there. And we heard from Mathieu van der Poel, who acknowledged that he had been quite tired after his Italian exploits, Tirreno Adriatico and then Milan-San Remo. He didn't do the recon for E3 and seemed to need a little bit of a break after that. Didn't ride at Gent-Wevelgem. But it was interesting what he said about E3, that when he ended up in that move and was outnumbered by the De Koenig Quickstep riders, that he missed Wout van Aert. There was a real sense of, you know, it was a brilliant illustration of, you know, where a team of riders can be greater than the sum of their parts. And a real masterclass from De Koenig Quickstep in riding and against and beating individually stronger riders.
Yeah, as I was watching the race on Friday, Daniel's comments about Milan-San Remo and the need for a kind of microscope to spot some of the important tactical influences came to mind, because I think the absolute opposite was true at E3. You kind of knew, you know, there were some big grandstand moves going on, not least De Koenig Quickstep, the way they took the race up about 80 kilometres out, absolutely smashed it to bits going into the bottom of the Tyrannberg, really put the pressure on, had numbers going over the top of that climb or reaching the top of that climb, you know, both sides of the road, they were really massing and making a statement of intent. And yet Van Aert and Van der Poel were the two riders that everyone was watching and waiting for. And you could see at various times, particularly Matteo Trentin was very alert, marking, not almost unsure whether to mark Van Aert or Van der Poel, because we weren't quite sure which one of them was going to make a move. And it did feel like there was a sense of inevitability and a big, big attack would go on the final climb, which is the Tegenberg. But before that, Van Aert, of course, had his puncture, and that meant that Jumbo Visma's riders, who had probably just been sitting, watching, waiting, thinking that their job was done for the day, had to really get involved and work hard to get him back up to the front group. And it was just a fascinating race to watch, knowing that De Koenig Quickstep had those numbers and wondering how they would play it. And they played it absolutely perfectly. Kasper Asgreen went 66 kilometres to go. You know, very difficult man to chase, even though it was one against several. But even as the gap came down, it wasn't a done deal. And I do think the fact that they didn't catch Asgreen before the final climb was pivotal, really. That was a thing that made it, because it wasn't just a case of attacking off the front of the bike race. There was still going to be a rider up the road. And in a way, that would have played even more into the hands of De Koenig Quickstep. And as you said at the start, Rich, Van Aert dropped himself with that attack. You know, he pulled, half a dozen pedal strokes, looking very good for a minute, and then suddenly looking completely empty. And it was a real spectacular blow. And then it was all eyes.
It was something I tried to emulate when I was out on my ride on Saturday. Did that a few times.
And then it was all eyes on Van der Poel. And I know, you know, perhaps being a little critical of Van der Poel because he's got so much about him. But in a moment like that sort of final 15 kilometres where Asgreen was going to get caught, and it was obvious it was going to get caught, but it wasn't necessarily up to Van der Poel to do as much work, I don't think, as he did. I mean, obviously everyone's looking at him, so he probably felt that he had to do it, but perhaps it could have been a bit cuter and let somebody else do some chasing. But then when you've got so many riders in blue jerseys sitting there watching, waiting, you know, they're very, very difficult to beat the numbers. And in the finale, I thought they played it absolutely perfectly. Send Asgreen, because absolutely nothing to lose. 5 kilometres to go, thereabouts. You know, he would have been tired, of course, but, you know, maybe a little bit of complacency, nobody leaping on his wheel, thinking, well, I don't really want to get stuck up there with 5 kilometres to go with a guy being out in front for 50K. And it worked an absolute treat for them. And even though AG2R had a couple of riders in there, you know, there weren't the numbers to bring Asgreen back. A sensational ride by the team. And it just made me think, can they do that over a race like the Tour of Flanders, which is 60 kilometres longer? And I have my doubts. But in a race like E3, which is intense, difficult, loads of set-piece moments in it, it was a fantastic watch just to, you know, you can look at the end and go, well, De Koenig Quickstep would have been, they would have got the hairdryer treatment from Patrick Lefebvre if they'd not won the race with the numbers they had. But, it still had to be, you know, got over the line, and they did it really well.
I'm just wondering, chaps, whether you agree that, you know, that the instincts of Van der Poel and Van Aert are such and are so sort of tilted towards selective, hard, aggressive racing early on. We saw that in Gent-Wevelgem yesterday, that they might possibly be scoring own goals or leaving themselves as kind of sitting ducks, because in small groups and, you know, even a group of the size that we saw yesterday in Gent-Wevelgem, the likelihood is going to be that they might be isolated. It wasn't the case yesterday. Van Aert had Van Hooydonk, and that was the reason why he won the race in the end. But if, you know, we do get a very aggressive race early on in the Tour of Flanders, you know, there is a high likelihood we'll get a small group with both Van Aert and Van der Poel in there with no teammates. Everyone will be looking at them, and you know, there might well be more than one Deceuninck Quick-Step rider, and then it becomes really difficult for them. When you're talking about two guys, Van der Poel and Van Aert, who, if the racing wasn't aggressive, wasn't selective, and there was a big group left at the end, they would arguably have a better chance of winning. Van Aert would potentially win a sprint if the whole peloton came in to the finish. So, you know, I just, as I say, it's great for the public watching, and you know, it's obviously the racing style that Van der Poel enjoys, but it wouldn't shock me if they found themselves in that position again within a group with two or three Deceuninck Quick-Step riders, you know, 40, 30k from the finish on Sunday at Tour of Flanders. And then it would become, I think, very difficult for them.
I think that we forget how they're not that young, but they're still quite inexperienced in these races. And I got a real sense of Van Aert learning an awful lot, even from Friday, and taking that into Sunday's race. He said that he'd been guilty on Friday of showing too much too early. And I thought his performance on Sunday was kind of masterful as well, because he was patient. He didn't, you know, he was very, as we heard from Nathan Van Hooydonk, he'd impressed upon him the importance of not losing contact third time up the Kemmelberg. He did, and then he got back on. And he was such an important ally to Van Aert. And that was, you know, Van Aert, even a couple of weeks ago, might have gone so hard up the Kemmelberg himself that he'd have lost his teammate and remained with some of the fastest sprinters.
He almost did, didn't he?
He almost did. But
he dropped Van Hooydonk.
It was a slightly more patient performance, though, I thought. And they probably both need to do that. Tour of Flanders is that much longer and more selective that, you know, it could just come down to the strongest guys. It could be like last year, Van Aert, Van der Poel, and Alaphilippe, who knows? But yeah, they're still learning, I think, both of them. They're still learning how to race these races.
And aren't these races about a little bit of bluff as well? I mean, I sort of alluded to it in the roundup at the start. You know, Van Aert, kind of the spectacular blow-up. I'm not for a minute saying he put that on, because I just don't think he did. But, you know, these races are, these are the starters before the main course of the Tour of Flanders. And, you know, I just remember Sean Kelly saying the big danger is that you show too much and make everybody even more aware of your strength for the big one. And, you know, Van der Poel, he didn't ride the perfect race, did he, on Friday? But with him not then riding on Sunday, and Richard, you're talking about the fatigue having gone pretty deep in Tirreno Adriatico, which may in turn have been why he, you know, didn't look as good as we were expecting him to look in Milan-San Remo. You know, Van Aert has ridden both races, won one of them. Van der Poel, very different build up towards the Tour of Flanders by not doing Gent-Wevergem, which is obviously, you know, the closest in terms of distance, if not quite the same in terms of that intensity that you get in the last 100k of the Tour of Flanders. But all roads are leading towards the Tour of Flanders, and they will have learned a lot about themselves and about each other, I think. And so, you know, there was lots to take out of both races, I thought. And I completely get what you're saying about the way Van Aert rode the final 50k on Sunday, because he could very easily have gone from the top of the Kemmelberg and thought, well, this is my move, and you know, splintered it down, and it could have been just him against Trentin, Colbrelli, Michael Matthews, maybe, if a little group had gone away. But he played the percentages. The smart move was to keep the teammate. And, of course, Van Hooydonk made that attack in the run-in, which enabled Van Aert to just sit, wait for the sprint and put the pressure on everybody else. So in its own way.
And a terrific lead-out. Van Hooydonk, a brilliant lead-out as well. He was a real revelation. I made the comment to Jan Peter that Jumbo-Visma did have a good team for these cobbled classics, but they've lost a couple of really important riders, Mike Tournison and Tom Dumoulin, who was going to be riding the Tour of Flanders. So it's a slightly makeshift lineup they've been riding with, and I thought Van Hooydonk really did well.
If you're Richard Plugger, do you send for Rog on for Sunday? We've never seen Primoz Roglic on the cobbles, have we? But I'm sure he would be more than competent. But
I want to. I could
live serious suggestion.
I could live to regret this, but I'm very worried about AG2R.
yes,
you know, they've invested quite a lot in their classics team, and it's just, it looks like they've just, you know, bought some strong riders rather than have them working as a team. I mean, Oliver Nassen and Golden Greg Van Avermaet have been up there in the races, but not really working coherently together, it doesn't look like. It doesn't look like there's an awful lot of communication going on or any kind of plan being executed at all. One of our listeners actually emailed in asking why Greg Van Avermaet wears a golden helmet. It's because, of course, he is the reigning Olympic road race champion, which he's been for about 18 years now. He will lose that at some point. I spoke to Jan Peter about that because we were watching Van Avermaet at the start in Gent-Wevelgem, and you know, he's got the golden helmet, golden cuffs on his jersey, golden touches on his shoes, all over his bike. And I said, none of that really sits all that comfortably on Van Avermaet, who's a very down-to-earth guy. And Jan Peter said that was absolutely true. And he apparently feels very uncomfortable being all blinged up. And but there's a certain amount of pressure from sponsors and so on to keep the gold. So I don't think he's very comfortable with it.
Why don't they tell him it's not gold? Tell him it's not gold, it's bronze.
Brown.
I'd like to see him where they ride the Tour of Flanders on Sunday with a huge medallion.
On that point about AG2R, Rich, because as I was watching the race, I was swapping a few messages with our friend Ed Pickering, the editor of Pro Cycling Magazine, and he said as they were approaching the run-in, do Nassen and Van Avermaet finish second and third, third and fourth, or fourth and fifth? And they actually ended up fourth and sixth. And I think the problem they've got is that neither of them are explosive in the same way that Van der Poel or Van Aert are. And they're probably, you know, why didn't Nassen or Van Avermaet make the Askren move, for example? You know, if not the first one, then...
Or follow him.
That was really smart by De Koenig Quickstep, because I think if you saw Askren going from that group, you think, he's not going to have any legs. I'm going to just go over there and it's just might as well be on my own. And that actually wasn't the case because Askren was still strong. But I think that was where De Koenig Quickstep played that finale so smartly, because if they'd sent Stibar or Seneschal, that would have been a move definitely worth marking and probably wouldn't have got away. But I think there was that sense of complacency with Askren.
Last throw of the dice, wasn't it, with Askren?
Well, But it was far enough out, 5 kilometres, that if it then got caught with 3 to go, you've still got one other move to play. That was what made it so clever, I thought. But Nassen could have made that move first, got in there early, and knowing that Van Avermaet, or vice versa, knowing that Van Avermaet was sitting behind. But they didn't really do anything.
It's not, and it's not just those two. There are other big signings. Bob Jungels has had a very, very slow start to the year as well.
He
was riding Catalunya.
Yeah, he's suffering from back problems, I believe.
Right, that explains that.
Back or hip.
Okay, that explains a lot. But yeah, I mean, AG2R not looking all that solid at the moment.
They're a bit too CV, aren't they?
Oliver Nassen's going to win the Tour of Flanders now. It's absolutely guaranteed.
Just a couple of final points, chaps, looking ahead to Sunday and Tour of Flanders. Trek Segafredo obviously had to sit out the weekend. Could that work in their favour? Because, Lionel, you were talking about not showing your hand too early, and we haven't really seen Mads Pedersen in action yet in the Cobble Classic. So I think they're riding, they're down to ride Dwarsdorf, London in the week, but that will be interesting. Another thing to consider is I noticed Dirk De Wolf, former Liège-Bastogne-Liège champion, also won Dwarsdorf, London, I think. He was speaking on Sports, the Belgian channel, yesterday, I believe, about how Wout van Aert possibly rides differently when Mathieu van der Poel isn't there. I'm not saying they get kind of drawn into an appendage swinging contest, but is it possible that van Aert, you know, the sort of cool head that he showed yesterday, that hasn't really been a feature of his riding when Van der Poel's been present. I remember last year at Gent-Wevelgem, there was that sort of fit of pique, which was quite uncharacteristic from Van Aert after the finish, when he said, well, he suggested that Van der Poel was riding to stop him winning. Obviously, again, it's fantastic for spectators, their rivalry, but they do... they almost define each other. Their rivalry is defining their career at the moment, and they must, you know, be very aware of what each other is doing in races.
Yeah, they sort of kind of swallow up all of the attention, don't they? If they move, everybody wants to be on their wheel. But I mean, that's an opportunity for others though as well, because, you know, if people can get up the road early, we talk about the Tour of Flanders being this race of phases, don't we? And there are years when the sort of the middle phase, the attacks that go 60-ish, 70-ish kilometres from the finish do end up really shaping the race. And so if people can get up the road early and be up the road early, they could maybe blunt Van Aert and Van der Poel a little bit. Got to bear in mind also Peter Sagan, who's running into a little bit of form, won a stage in Catalunya. A big jump up from that to a Tour of Flanders type distance and intensity, but you never know. And also there's that sense of it being so much more important. You know, Van Aert was able to play, you know, the absolute opposite ends of the spectrum on Friday and Sunday, you know, go for the all-out eyeball-catching explosive attack on the final climb on Friday, and then just sit tight and play the perfect tactical move on Sunday. And the Tour of Flanders, the stakes are all that much higher, aren't they? And bear in mind what happened to him last year. You know, again, Richard, you were talking about Milan-San Remo. You know, not just because you don't win the race doesn't mean you didn't ride a good race. You can ride the perfect race and not win. And in a way, that's what happened to Van Aert in last year's Tour of Flanders, isn't it? The danger is that they could ride brilliantly all day and just that it will come down to the finest of margins. It could come down to the finishing straight again.
On that note, Marina Voss won the women's race. There was a terrific performance again from Elisa Longo Borghini in the purple jersey of Women's World Tour leader. The men's World Tour leaders don't wear a jersey anymore, do they? An awful lot of purple jerseys in the women's peloton this year, so that was confusing. But she rode an incredible race, and had the course not been increased by a kilometre because of that fire that forced the rerouting, she would have won. she would have won the race, or certainly she would have contested the finish with Soraya Paladin, and I suspect she would have won. We'll have a lot more from Women's Gent-Wevelgem in the cycling podcast Femina, which is out next week. So we'll be covering Tour of Flanders as well, and hopefully looking forward to the first Women's Paris-Roubaix.
Are we sure that fire that caused the final few kilometres of Gent-Wevelgem to be rerouted, that wasn't anything to do with the way that Van Aert combusted on Friday afternoon, was it? A few kilometres away. No connection between those two events.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport, our long-term sponsors. You can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25, SISCP25. And please do send in your questions for James Morton at Science and Sport. James Morton, who's hosting the new Science and Sport podcast, actually. They've launched their own podcast as well, covering all sports. Geraint Thomas was in the first one, so check that out as well. But email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, if you would like James Morton to answer your sports nutrition questions. contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. Before we move on to Catalunya, I think there was a little bit of unfinished business from Gent-Wevelgem. I think you wanted to, surprised at this actually, Daniel, you wanted to dwell a little bit on Sam Bennett's unfortunate incident, because I would have thought...
Not me.
Have thought that would fall into the category of bodily functions that you would prefer not to acknowledge happen.
Well, it does.
Okay.
I think
Lionel wants to dwell on that. Sorry.
Your August fellow host, Mr. Burney.
But it was interesting, wasn't it, that the big move had Bennett, Michael Matthews, Van Aert in it. Michael Matthews had teammates as well. Bike Exchange were looking good. And the obvious question is, why would Sam Bennett, who's got a good sprint, want to spend all day in the break up the road? Well, I guess the answer to that is it minimises the risk of getting dropped on any of the climbs if the race is really on. He did really, really well to get back on after losing a bit of distance on the final time over the Kemmelberg, which is the straight, steep, probably shorter but harder side of the Kemmelberg. And he did get back on, but then on that flatter road, as they were, it's a long, interminable run into the finish and everyone waiting for that sprint. And he, well, as we saw on the TV, he was throwing up. And Richard, what actually caused that, did he say afterwards?
Well, yeah, he did come through the mix zone and you know, you're supposed to keep your distance at the moment, obviously, with COVID regulations, but we kept a bit more of a distance. Although I was studying his clothing and his bike to see if there were any signs of this. Sorry, going to disgusting detail here, but there were no signs of any sickness on his person. But he said he'd overeaten. I think you mentioned it's a long race. You know, it's 250 kilometres, and it was a big day out for those guys working hard. And I think he got his fueling wrong in overeating. I think he ate too much, either on the run into the final time up the Kemmelberg or just after. And, well, we all saw the results. And he was obviously pretty empty afterwards. I missed opportunity for him, but he did incredibly well to last as long as he did on what's become quite a tough race, because it used to be more of a sprinter's race, but it's become harder over the years.
And yet, chaps, I mean, Lionel, you called it a break. It was more that the selection that took place was more sort of, the strongest guys coming to the front, wasn't it, in crosswinds? And curiously, most of them were what you would usually call sprinters, which is sort of strange, and it kind of shows the overlap between, you know, the explosive power needed to get up some of these bergs in the Flandrian races and, well, sprinting itself. But I suppose it says something about the way cycling's evolved in the last few years that the sprinters are certainly no longer one-trick ponies, are they?
I think it's evolving into a really good race, Gent-Wevergem. I mean, it's got these different elements. First of all, I mean, they've moved the start to Ypres, which obviously ties it into the history of the battlefields and all of the First World War imagery, which is so evident. I mean, they're going past cemeteries for much of the day. It's very, very flat around there and exposed. You know, the wind's coming in off the sea, so crosswinds are a feature, as we saw on Sunday. And then the cobbled climbs, the cobbled sections, then the addition of the plug streets in recent years. That's the sort of gravelly farm tracks. Really fun to ride, actually, as Simon Gill and I did a few years ago now. But, you know, not kind of Strada Bianca type of gravel, slightly different grade of gravel. I think, you know, if you're buying some gravel for your driveway, it's a bit more like that on the plug streets. And then, well, the Kemmelberg is a great climb, and the fact that they go the two different ways up it, you know, really makes a feature of that hill. And it's one of those ones, it's basically doesn't seem to matter which way you approach the Kemmelberg, it seems to be uphill and into a headwind whether you're coming from one direction or the other direction. It's just hard cycling around there, and I think that's what we saw on that run in from the final climb to the finish. You know, it would take a real kind of strong effort to try and get away from a group that had that amount of power in it. And of course, you know, Nizzolo, Trentin, Colbrelli, Van Aert, of course, Matthews, they're all that kind of roadman sprinter, to use the kind of the old-fashioned term. You know, they're not just pure speed, they're strength. You know, they can, you know, wins from small groups, but they can have their day in big bunch sprints as well. And that's what made the finish so fascinating. And as you said, Rich, what made the presence of a Jumbo-Visma teammate for Van Aert so crucial? Because it would have been actually really interesting to see whether the result would have been the same had Van Aert been on his own. I suspect there might have been a little bit more attacking. But out of that group, other than Stefan Kuhn, who was going to risk,
I mean,
going out on the attack, knowing that they had to sprint to fall back?
Stefan Kuhn did try an attack, didn't he? But it was one of those attacks where he didn't actually put his nose in front of Van Hooydonk, who was on the front anyway. It was... Mm. It was an underwhelming sort of attack. Bit of a diesel, isn't the old Stefan Kung? But you haven't asked me about my ride on Saturday. I'm amazed that you haven't been quizzing me on that. Can we maybe spend the next 15 minutes discussing that? I went up the Moor in Herardsbergen and then came back via the Oude Quaremont and the Paterberg. You'll find me on the Strava leaderboards for all these climbs. I think I'm certainly among the top 11,000 up the Paterberg this year, which I was pretty pleased about.
Well, judging from the photo you sent me on Saturday evening, you saved your overeating for dinner time.
I did. I deserved that. My Ghent stew.
Was it good? Was it a good Flemish stew? It looked nice.
It was excellent. It was excellent. I was staying in a hotel in Oudenaarde, which is a cycling-themed hotel, the Leopold Hotel. Cofidis was staying there as well, and Alpes and Fenix, actually. And it was a really nice place to stay. It's a lovely town, Oudenaarde. And you forget, I haven't ridden my bike in Belgium for 3 or 4 years. You do forget the culture around cycling there, not just the sport, but the activity, the infrastructure that's there to help you ride safely around Belgium is mind blowing when you're kind of exposed to it again. It's an absolute joy to ride a bike there.
It's quite bewildering, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you come up to a roundabout and the cars stop for you.
Oh, cyclists
have priority.
It's extraordinary. It is extraordinary, and you know, it does, when you haven't experienced that for a few years, it takes your breath away a little bit. Even compared to here in France, it's a different world. A completely different world. So thoroughly enjoyable. We should move on to Catalonia, chaps. Before we do, let's do slow radio while I remember.
Well, we should really give it some kind of prediction for
Flanders. For Flanders. 18 riders to watch?
Well, no, unfortunately, I haven't got around to that. I've been slightly ambushed. We did the podcast quite early this morning. But I think everything, I mean, really, there's no need to name 18. I think everything points to a victory for the criminally underrated Anthony Turgiste.
Oh, yeah. I think you're right.
I thought, Daniel, you were going to name 18 riders who will all finish pretty well up there, but not the winner.
He's got form.
We talked earlier today about sightings of little or very elusive individuals. Has anyone seen Edvald Boasenhagen this year?
Yes, I saw him yesterday. Yeah. But... I mean, I was thinking about that as well. Nicky Terpstra, you know?
I know.
You know, a guy who moved to that team with two monuments in his pocket has really, really not done anything. He's had some bad crashes, but he really hasn't done anything.
No, he was briefly off the front, wasn't he, in E3. He tried a little attack, but it was a very, very little, tiny, almost invisible attack.
I'm looking at Pro Cycling Stats, and they've got the top competitors for the Tour of Flanders, and included, it's all obviously done on rankings rather than actual favourite status for this race, but Warren Barguil is down there. I don't think he'd be one of your top 18, would he?
No.
Who would be in your top 18, though, Daniel?
Well, you catch me if you're not. No, I can't. Well, I just said that. I haven't been able to come up with a top 18.
Well, we know that Oliver Nassen's going to win it, yeah, that's pretty much it, isn't it?
Why don't you do the top 18, Daniel, and we'll post it on the Cycling Podcast Twitter before the weekend.
That. Yeah, that's enough of predictions. Slow radio. This comes from Rich Michele. I hope I'm saying your name correctly, Rich Michele. Or Michele. I'm not quite sure. But you have written to us from Washington, D.C., you have a restaurant in Arlington, the Portofino restaurant, to which we're all invited, chaps. The slow radio is a section of his ride on the CNO canal from DC to Cumberland in Maryland this week. The canal is 185 miles of gravel riding in a national park. This recording was made around the last 10-15 miles of my journey. I broke up the route into a variety of rides. The beginning has some frogs in the background, and I come across more frogs at the end of the recording. Fantastic, because my brother lives in Washington, D.C., and he is a herpetologist, a frog expert, so he'll love this as well. Let's hear a bit of Rich's ride.
Mm-hmm.
Ribbit, ribbit. Well, that was that was a bit of slow radio from Rich Michele or Michele. Thank you very much for that, and we'd love to visit your restaurant, Rich, and appreciated the frogs. Now, if you've got a bit of slow radio to send us in, and we're getting lots now, actually, email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. And we've released a lot of new episodes for friends of the podcast, and if you want to sign up as a friend, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. The Lionel Flanders has just been re-released, a great great listen as part of your build-up to the Tour of Flanders. We've got another friend special coming out very soon as well, don't we, Daniel?
Oh, we have, this week.
Yeah,
this week,
tell us a bit about it, because I've had a listen. It's a great story, not one that people will be familiar with.
Well, it's a story that in some senses is familiar, typical. We've heard similar stories numerous times over the years of riders who have nearly made it to the big time, but just fallen short, and, you know, for assorted reasons. In this case, the rider in question is a Northern Irish rider called Marcus Christie, who you may or may not have come across in the past. And Marcus was a great prospect, particularly well on the track and in time trials, and finished on the podium of the Irish National Championships on numerous occasions. And he had a very rocky ride over about 10 years. He was at the UCI Academy in Switzerland, again, because he was really identified as a major talent. And things turned sour, and he tried his luck again with En Poste, the road race team that was is well known for its affiliation with Sean Kelly. And again, it's a real sort of a warts and all account of cycling in the kind of lower leagues and on that sort of slippery slope towards the exalted heights of the World Tour, and what can go wrong and what often does go wrong. And also the sort of battle that young guys fight to, you know whether they should continue to pursue their dream in the face of adversity. When is the right time to say, to call time on that dream? Marcus Christie is the star of the show. It's his story, and it's going to be out this week.
It's a terrific piece of storytelling with an incredible twist in the tale as well. So do give that a listen if you're a friend of the podcast, and if you'd like to sign up, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. Catalunya, I must admit, chaps, my attention was in Flanders, so I didn't pay as much attention to Catalunya as I should have done, but a pretty dominant performance there for Ineos Grenadiers.
Absolutely, yes. Top three on the podium. Adam Yates winning the race. He was second at the UAE Tour last month, remember? But probably the first thing to say about the Volta Catalunya was it was the 100th edition of the race this year, making it the third oldest World Tour stage race after the Tour de France and the Giro d'Italia. A race that, I guess because of the time of year, it does tend to go a little bit under the radar because the Cobble Classics are on and a lot of our focus is on that. But I really enjoyed watching it this week, particularly like the leader's jersey, the white with the narrow green stripes, which is inspired by US Saints, which is a sports club which is instrumental in organising the race, sort of almost Celtic-esque.
I must say, one thing that disappointed me slightly about the Volta a Catalunya this year was I didn't think it was very pretty. I don't think it's a race that necessarily shows off the region of Catalunya to its best effect. I mean, we talk a lot about the touristic vocation of grand tours and 1 week stage races, and that is an important part of why these races go ahead. And Catalunya is a region that we don't, for political reasons, often we don't visit very much in the Vuelta a España, and it's a region I'm very curious about, and is loved by cyclists. You know, professional cyclists have flocked to Girona in recent years, and I have often watched the Volta a Catalunya, particularly this year, and felt I didn't really, it didn't really tempt me, entice me to visit the region as much as I would have liked.
I don't know. I thought that the finish in Mataró looked very nice on the coast there. That was not a place I'm terribly familiar with. And then the final stage, it was a slightly different way up the familiar hill, which takes the race past the Olympic Stadium that hosted the athletics at the 1992 Olympics, doesn't it? The sort of outskirts of Barcelona, and you get some nice shots of the city. But I guess it's not quite a patch on the Tour de Basque Country or Itzulia, which is is spectacular at this time of year. Well, the race is coming up next week, isn't it? It's very green, beautiful, dramatic scenery. But I mean, you know, Catalonia can't just change its geographic and geological history to suit you, Daniel. It is what it is, you know.
No, but I think it is. I think it is a very beautiful region, but particularly the weekend stages. Okay, Barcelona, you know, it certainly has its appeal and it's spectacular. It's a good circuit. It's a good racing circuit. But the Saturday stage, I found quite unremarkable. And one of the stages, or a couple of stages last week, aside from the big mountain stages as well, I didn't come away, as I say, wowed by the landscapes. And you know, this is a minor gripe. I mean, as far as the racing was concerned, it was an exciting race, and it was a really high quality field, and a really ominous shot across the bows by Ineos. You know, we talked in the winter, didn't we, about how much firepower they have in their stage racing lineups, not just the one they're going to send to the Tour de France, but the one they'll send to the Giro and the Vuelta. And you know, the big question is just how they're going to cram it all into, well, three Grand Tour teams.
Adam Yates winning the Battle of the Brothers.
Yes,
pretty decisively.
Very decisively.
Yeah, and I mean, I facetiously called him Adam Craig David Yates on Twitter, because Craig David, of course, the maestro of British garage and R&B in the late 90s, early noughties. And he had a famous song, 7 Days. And Adam Yates' record in one week stage races is superb. Second only to Primoz Roglic in the world.
Well, the thing is, Simon Yates is targeting the Giro in May, isn't he? And Adam Yates, as we still understand it, the only Grand Tour on his calendar this year is the Vuelta a España, which starts in mid-August. And according to Rod Ellingworth, that is still the plan. But like you say, I mean, a real ominous lineup when you can, Grand Tour champions in Geraint Thomas and Richard Carapaz, and Richie Porte, who was third in the Tour de France last year, of course, and Adam Yates. I mean, can anyone else match that in a lineup?
The curious thing is that as things stand, they're two in-form riders, and the riders who've been most impressive this year, Adam Yates and Egan Bernal, are not going to the Tour de France. Mm. They're going to the Giro and the Vuelta, although Bernal may go to the Tour as well.
Yates is also a rider. Were they to be tempted to throw him into the, you know, their lineup, their sort of mountain train for the Tour de France, he's not someone who's really played that role. He's familiar with that role. He's only really ever ridden for himself. I'm sure, you know, the Vuelta that Simon won.
Remember, he did come
correct.
Into his own the last couple of days, but he was actually very, very quiet that whole race. Now, that was presented at the time as you know, he'd been sort of held back until those tough stages in Andorra right at the end of the race. And he did a great job there, but he certainly wasn't somebody who was all that present through the rest of the race.
No, he's never been designated, gone into a big race as a mountain domestique. The first intention has always been to sort of ride for his own chances. A couple of other sort of footnotes, just cleaning up from Catalunya chaps. The return of Alejandro Valverde, the best he's looked since
the
2019, since the 70s. The return as well of Esteban Chavez. Chavez, of course, has had a lot of problems. He had a version of, if it wasn't Epstein-Barr a couple of years ago, suffered from that, or I think 2017. And since then, it's really struggled. Won a mountain stage at the Giro, but it wasn't really, the mountain stage of the Giro was from a break. It wasn't quite a la pedal in the same way that, well, he had one very good stage in Catalunya where he finished second behind Yates. And then the following day, he dropped all of the best riders In the race in the peloton and went on his own and looked very fit, looked skinny. We've mentioned in the last couple of years that one concern with Chavez has been he's been just a little bit heavier than in his best years, and he looks back to his fighting weight and possibly also, we're talking about weight, relieved of the burden of, well, Adam Yates in the team. He's now, alongside Simon Yates, very much someone they'll be looking to in the Grand Tours to star in the mountains alongside Lucas Hamilton as well, who also rode well in Catalonia, finished 10th overall.
They had three in the top 10. Team Bike Exchange also rode very well at Gent-Wevelgem, of course. And that was a bright spot, Chavez, but the race seemed to me as notable for the disappointing performances of some other riders as for the impressive performances by Ineos. Sepp Kuss in particular, that was his big chance to lead the team.
It didn't surprise me, Rich. I mean, we've talked about it, haven't we? He's sort of leaking time here and there. And to be honest, in fairness to Kuss, I think he has acknowledged this in interviews, and I think the team has acknowledged. They're very, very conscious of this. Well, of how raw he is as a GC prospect, and it showed at Catalunya.
Yeah. Well, listen, we should wrap things up for this week. We've got Dwarsdorf Londrin this week to look forward to. Matthew van der Poel is riding there. And then, of course, the big one, the Tour of Flanders. I'll be there on Sunday very much looking forward to that. I'm not riding, Lionel. I'm not riding.
You will have another massive plate of Ghent stew, won't you? Rich beef in beer, brewed in, marinated in beer and
oh yeah, I might not actually, because I think I'm just doing it as a day trip, unfortunately, so I might not be able to do that, but if I can, I will.
Just before we go, Rich, a mention for Mitch Docker's podcast, Life in the Peloton. The next episode will be out on Wednesday, and his guest this week is Ineos Grenadiers rider Tom Pidcock, who we saw very prominent in Milan San Remo a couple of weeks ago. So Tom Pidcock is the guest on Life in the Peloton. That will be out on Wednesday.
Anyway, we'll be back next week with a report from the Tour of Flanders. And thank you very much. Thank you, Lionel.
Thanks, Rich.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast with Lionel Burney, Daniel Freeb and Richard Moore. To become a friend of the podcast or to sign up for our weekly newsletter, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. Our theme music is by Glass Pear, and this episode was produced by Hugh Owen.